Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's Managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta can make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab-tested, real results. Go to Mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's Mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
Told the Netflix numbers, I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably five different times, I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
A whole part of the show, man.
Welcome to an earlier edition of Pollock and Thurston coming at you on Wednesday afternoon. And I'm here with Brandon Thurston. As always, Brandon, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
We're doing well. We're doing well. Brandon and I were having an offline discussion about potentially moving on, separating ways. And I am holding Brandon to a no-compete period if he ever chooses to walk away through our vigorous partnership that we have held to one another. 10-year non-competes.
I did realize
Brandon and I.
That was in the contract when I signed on.
It is.
2021.
It is. Yes.
Yeah. There'll be no pay. In fact, I have to pay you. Yes.
Yeah. 10 years, 20 years, you know, these things that are standard business practice. We're going to talk about everyone's favorite clauses in WWE contracts today, but you're not going to have to just rely on us. We are going to be rejoined by our favorite combat sports regulatory lawyer, Eric McGraken, will be on the show a little later on. We're going to talk about a very interesting hearing that the California State Athletic Commission held last week, featuring the one and only Nick Khan calling in you wouldn't believe it, to voice his support for the Muhammad Ali Boxing Revival Act that TKO is pursuing. And we're also going to get Eric's thoughts on some of these clauses that have come to the forefront over the last week as it pertains to WWE talent and trying to get out of their contracts to move on. And we had the Andrade situation that has kind of spurred on this whole discussion, because Andrade, released by WWE with cause, reportedly over several wellness violations, and then pops up on AEW programming on October the 1st. This is all considered it was a bit of a surprise that he showed up, but not one that he appeared to have any restrictions to do so. And then October 1st comes and goes. We get basically no more references to Andrade on AEW programming. He just disappears. And then we see segment after segment with the Don Callis family, no Andrade, everyone is concerned. And then it appears that there are restrictions on Andrade. And in fact, he is going to be held to a no-compete, which is believed to be a year, which is very likely an unpaid year-long period that Andrade could have to sit out for. So there has been basically no semblance of any explanation of this from Tony Khan last week, who
he did answer a question about this.
He did. I mean, the immediate question asked was from John Elba, who did press Tony Khan. He did get a follow up. He's a fan of Andrade. He's excited to see him, and basically relented and said, "I'm saying all that I can say."
He referred him to his comments when Andrade left WWE at the end of, what was it, 2023?
Yes.
He's been great to work with, great talent, great wrestler, great relationship. Everything's great.
Everything's great other than he's not here anymore.
Oh.
Well, he's not physically here anymore. Questions that we have are, is he technically under an AEW contract? Is he legally allowed to be under an AEW contract? Can AEW pay him during this period? I mean, those are questions I have. The second being, what is the recourse for Andrade and what are his options? This is, Fightful did a great job. They did get the actual clause that is found in these contracts that reads, upon termination of this agreement by the promoter, in this case WWE, for breach of the terms hereof, wrestler shall not work, appear, or perform in any capacity for any professional wrestling, sports entertainment, mixed martial arts, and or ultimate fighting organization, promotion, or entity not owned or controlled by the promoter in the United States for a period of up to 1 year from the date of such expiration or termination.
Now, we don't know that this is actually the language from, we don't know that this is identical to the language of Andrade's contract, but it's likely that that all these contracts have similar, if not exactly the same language as it pertains to this particular clause.
Yeah. Over the past week, we heard Lance Storm, who was working as a producer for WWE in 2019, that he had that. Now, he would have had an employee contract, not an independent contractor deal as a producer, but he reiterated this language existing in his 2019 deal. David Otunga as well spoke about a 2017 contract that had similar language in it. So it does feel like, barring maybe slight changes between contracts, that this has pretty much been boilerplate for most of the past decade, if not earlier. And then we can get into this Samantha Irvin situation that was just added upon things as well, but has forced kind of the view once again on these WWE contracts of what are, in Andrade's case, an independent contractor.
I think there's two separate issues here to scrutinize, which one is, I think what's probably, yeah, what is definitely getting more attention is this is a disadvantageous clause in a contract that is apparently broadly in almost everyone, if not everyone's talent contracts at WWE. But secondly, that AEW put him on television without realizing that this was the case. I understand that say if you're in Andrade's case, when you go from WWE to AEW, it's not like you can just share your contract with the company that you're moving to. I strongly believe there are confidentiality clauses in WWE contracts and AEW contracts that would legally prevent you from sharing your contract with the other guys. But that being said, you could still...
It's hard to imagine AEW would not be aware of this clause, not so much needing, like, if they're prohibited from physically seeing the contract, that you're dealing with enough talent that you would be aware, like, what are the landmines we don't want to step upon when we are going after these talents? Yeah. And maybe it was just something as simple as, like, obviously there was some miscommunication here, whether it was between WWE to Andrade, Andrade to AEW, or something in between.
I spoke with one agent who is not Andrade's agent, but expressed that, one thing you can ask for if you're departing one company is some sort of written confirmation about what you're limited to do. If you are under an NDA is a different story, a non-compete, then they put that in writing. So you understand what exactly your limits are. If you've got a 90-day, a 1-year non-compete, and I mean,
it's like the
I don't know that didn't happen, but evidently that didn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, it could be like, was Andrade informed there's no 90-day no compete involved? Like, technically there is not, but obviously, like, I can't state to how this was conveyed.
But perhaps what AEW could have done is said, okay, we need something in writing here to make sure that you're not under a non-compete period here before we put you on TV.
Yes. And, you know, they kind of dealt with this situation, although somewhat different, because Renee Paquette had a one-year non-compete after leaving WWE in the summer of 2021. But again, she was under an employee contract at WWE, same as Samantha Irvin. Andrade would have not been under an employee contract. But I have a hard time imagining that this is in your standard WWE contract. And, you know, we did know he was fired. This was not as though this were some, you know, hushed up story about the terms of what he was not just part of a group of releases, and the fact that he was fired came out later. That was known in advance. So there is certainly that question about things. The other is, if you're Andrade, and what your options are in this. Like, is there some kind of remedy where the one-year period can be relaxed to a lesser amount of time? I don't know what incentivizes WWE to, if they are willing to defend this contract practice, like what incentive is there for WWE to relax this period from a year to 6 months, for instance?
I mean, I believe it's unlikely this is going to go to court, but I did learn too that generally in W contracts, talent contracts, they agree to resolve disputes, not in arbitration like in AEW contracts apparently, but in a federal court in Connecticut, which is the same venue where other cases like the Janelle Grant lawsuit are being litigated. So if there was a lawsuit here, which I think is pretty unlikely, then it would go to federal court, and it would raise all kinds of unwanted disclosures, including perhaps the contract itself. It could lead to really undesirable precedents being set. So I don't think that would happen. At least, you know, W certainly have to, you know, reason to not want it to get there. And it, you know, Andrade might have good reason to not want to burn his bridge as well.
I think that's the overriding factor here. It's several fold. Number one is that for Andrade to fight this, what is the expense that you would have to incur versus the amount that you are out over this period? Like, this is not going to be solved overnight with a legal situation. So, I mean, you're spending a lot to have to go fight this. Number two, it's certainly going to be disadvantageous for somebody that is in his mid-30s and maybe does not want to completely exclude the option of one day going back to WWE and not wanting a legal fight to preclude that. And I think you also look at the fact that he can work outside of the US. There's that option for him, but it's an extremely restrictive clause for any performer. But I think that's a larger issue that if a talent is faced with this exceptionally restrictive clause, like they have no bargaining power when it comes to these contracts. Like, if you do not sign this, we are not going to sign you, point blank. And everyone is going to sign these deals. And the idea that, well, this would never hold up in court, that might be true, but these are probably not going to be tested until you get that one person that would be willing to fight this. And I think a reasonable judge would likely argue that as an independent contractor, a one-year unpaid period does not have merit. But that's a long road to getting that decision processed. And it's a what if. You can't guarantee that either.
And I got the impression from listening to, there's a video where David Otunga, who's a lawyer as well as former W talent, explains that the 90-day period, the fact that they pay talent who have been released for that 90-day period is not necessarily required by the contract, but they do that as a courtesy. It was the impression that I got from watching that. The fact that he's not being paid and he basically can't make a living in his chosen profession does seem to be hard to have a winning argument for that in court. But I understand too, like a one-year non-compete across business generally is not like an unheard of long period. It's not like it's a 10-year non-compete or something like that. So I think compared to the cases that end up in court about non-competes in general, 1 year is probably not, you know, a crazy long amount of time.
What is, like, the counter argument to this is that if you are WWE and you are putting these clauses in place so that if a talent realizes I could make more elsewhere and I've got 3 years left on my deal, how can I just break my contract and go to a competitor immediately? I think the argument would be, what is a sufficient amount of time? Is a year too harsh? I think at minimum, if you want to instill these non-compete periods, I think the baseline is you need to be able to have some kind of compensation for this period, if you want to be able to buy that amount of time off of a person. Whether that's the
you're talking about contract, like what's fair.
What I'm arguing that for WWE is like they don't want to be in a situation where talent can just break their contracts if they want to get out. Like, we've seen plenty of talent. They want to get out of contracts.
Refuse. Let's say we don't know what exactly there may have been wellness tests that are part of this. But if you, let's say, refuse to drug test, you would be perhaps eventually terminated because of that. Like, I'll do that because I want to go work for AEW instead.
Mm-hmm. And there's that aspect to it, is that like, if you wanted to be intentionally fired, should you be able to be paid in full for just violating your contract because you want to get out of the company? Because that is a portion, like, the company is protecting itself here. Right. Whether it is overstepping its bounds, it's not going to be challenged on those grounds. Realistically, it's looking to protect itself and to not allow for talent that can just want to get out of a deal, go elsewhere, or just be in violation of these contracts and be compensated for them.
Yeah, I think as far as this being legal, or I think there's a lot of assumptions being made about this would never stand up in court. I'm not sure. I think a judge might look at this and maybe narrow it down to say that, well, okay, you can't work for AEW for a year or the major competitors for a year, but you can work indies, you can work in for CCC in Puerto Rico. But I don't see them necessarily throwing it all out. I'm sure Eric would have a better idea of how that would play out. But really, I think this is, look, these talents agreed to this contract. I don't know if his agent didn't understand what he was agreeing to and then let him work for AEW for some reason, or they could have negotiated a different deal when he signed on. But this is what these talents are agreeing to. And is it fair? Probably not. Is it really advantageous? Is the scale really skewed towards WWE's favor in this? Yeah. And if talent, there's a high supply of talent, apparently, who are willing to make these agreements, it's something that collective bargaining could resolve, but probably won't.
Well, maybe when they have their next sit down meeting to divvy up the new rights deal from Netflix, they'll have that discussion.
They'll get 50% of the revenue, right? Yes. Which is like $500 million at least. And we'll start from there.
The holidays are fast approaching, but why not get your shopping done early and actually enjoy it? Uncommon Goods makes your holiday shopping easy and fun with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. I found this super cool Starry Night Air Fort. It's basically a blow-up fort covered in glow-in-the-dark stars. You just hook it up to a box fan, and in less than a minute, you have this awesome little space for the kids to play, or even for grown-ups to sneak in and have fun. It's lightweight, easy to pack away, and really great for relaxing or imaginative play at home. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting small businesses and artists, and with every purchase, they even give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. So shop early, have fun, and cross those names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/postwrestling. That's uncommongoods.com/postwrestling for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's managed hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
So on the heels of this story with Andrade, a fan online was remarking that it's been a year since Samantha Irvin, real name Samantha Johnson, left WWE as a ring announcer. And she replied to this stating, 1 year down, 1 year left on my non-compete. Happy anniversary. Can't wait. Hope you enjoy my songs in the meantime. And says, I hope to see you soon. Then in a follow-up, which didn't get as much attention, but another person, many people in her comments were just baffled by this, that she's got a 2 year non-compete, which, like, you tell me, outside of Brock Lesnar, I have never heard of this length of a non-compete for any performer in pro wrestling. So this would be certainly on the high end. Like, the comparison is Renee Paquette, and that we knew was she left in the summer of 21. She goes to AEW in October 2022 and was a 1 year non-compete. But Samantha was asked, like, you must be getting paid during this period, right? No, I'm not getting paid because I resigned from the position. I wasn't under a talent contract. I was an employee. So I was not in breach by leaving, which I'm trying to parse this language. She's explaining I was not in breach of anything while explaining why she's not getting paid for this. This is a baffling one to me. So it was not the fact that she had, like, she is deciphering. This is a non-compete period. This is not like I had 2 years left on my contract. So this sounds like a much more restrictive deal than we've seen for other employee situations in WWE. And it's not being paid for 2 years.
And I imagine that, you know, you can't work for AEW, New Japan, in the United States, at least, and probably at any,
I'm sure the language is very similar to an independent contract.
Any pro wrestling, any MMA company or anything like that. And it is baffling that you're just not allowed to make a living in the profession that you've created value for yourself in.
Yeah.
But they signed it.
Whether a judge would agree. But again, it's like there's no Samantha Johnson signed with this company in 2021. She had tried out at the Performance Center and they opted to sign her as a ring announcer. Like, what weight is she able to throw around? No, I don't want this contract, this clause in my contract. Bye bye.
Mm-hmm. None.
That's it. Yeah. Like, that's what all these situations are going to be. Andrade wants to leave AEW and go to WWE 2 years ago. You don't want this clause in? Okay, cool. We don't need you. Like, this is boilerplate, and they are not going to budge off of these clauses. It's going to take some kind of collective weight or somebody that can command that this could be, you know, stripped down. But that is not the history of professional wrestling.
Yeah, it would really take somebody to sue in federal court, and it would probably have to be WWE against WWE. And I mean, I don't know how a judge would interpret various parts of a contract, whether it's the employee classification, whether it's various parts of the contract, including these non-competes. It could, you know, essentially invalidate, you know, if W got an unfavorable ruling, that could invalidate some major parts of their contracts.
Yes. I would just like to know your professional opinion, Judge. If I get an injury and I'm out for 8 months, it's normal that gets tacked on and I have to make up for that injured time at the back end of my contract, right?
Right. And AEW's doing that too, apparently. Yeah. And I don't think that would hold up. But again, like, I think they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. I think talent are, because they're also eager to sign these contracts. They have no collective bargaining, and there's no path to collective bargaining, especially when the people who have the most leverage, who need to be a part of that is the top stars, are the ones who are most well taken care of for. They have the least to gain, the most to lose. And the people who have the most to gain and the least to lose are the ones who should want it the most, but they have the least leverage. So it's great to be a TKO shareholder, basically.
Frothy. Honestly, like, they're the opportunities for, I'll be specific to WWE because it is the industry leader, the opportunity for talent to have any meaningful leverage, it has lessened so significantly in the last 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. One of those very few opportunities, again, I go back to the start of the pandemic. We are right before, we've got to produce a WrestleMania in the PC. We don't know what the extent of this coronavirus is going to entail, what dangers you're putting yourself into. Okay, We are the product that you need to supply. We're sitting down as a collective, and there's going to be some give and take here because we are putting ourselves at harm's risk so that you can maintain your broadcast agreements, and you want to present your WrestleMania event, and we're going to be the ones putting ourselves at risk. We're giving you the right to get all of these rights fees in the midst of this pandemic when there's no other sports going on. And what do we get in? What are you going to reciprocate with? The reality was many of you will be fired in a few months once we get through the first wave of this pandemic. That's how things worked out. But that was one of the very few opportunities, if there was any kind of collective voice that was going to say, hey, we're sitting down and we're negotiating this, or else, hey, you cannot produce this show with a whole locker room that is not going to be going into a potential disaster zone in this performance center.
And that was an opportunity because their TV rights fees would have been at stake. But it's not like we heard much pushback. I mean, we have a story of Kevin Owens going to Vince to talk about the lack of masks and things like that. But you know what got a bigger pushback from talent was what a year later or so, when Vince decided to take away Twitch streams and Cameo and YouTube and actually directly take money away from people by doing that. And that's where you get the rumblings of SAG-AFTRA getting involved, which of course never came to fruition.
All right. We're going to welcome in our guest now. And on the other side, Brandon's done a really big breakdown of WWE ticket prices since the formation of TKO. Have they gone up or down?
They've gone up. Oh, sorry. Spoiler.
Oh, come on. Let's not bury the lead. TKO is doing wonderful on the ticketing side. But we welcome in our favorite combat sports attorney. We're going to chat some WWE no-compete clauses and what the hell went down in California last week. Eric McGrakin joins us from the West Coast. Eric, how are you today?
Hi, Eric.
Hey, John. I'm good. How you guys doing?
We're doing well. We're doing better than some former WWE talents that are trying to move on to life after WWE, but it's a bit restrictive for independent contractors. And I found this interesting, Eric, because I know you're focused very heavily on the state of, you know, TKO pushing this Ali Boxing Revival Act and the arguments that it's going to help so many of these boxers. And yet on the other wing of TKO is this story that we are following, where it's these extremely restrictive clauses that are being enforced, one with a performer named Andrade, who was fired by the company several months ago, and now it's largely been reported that he is bound by this clause that if you are fired for cause, it's like up to a 1 year non-compete, believed to be an unpaid period that they have. We have another former employee in Samantha Irvin who decided just to leave on her own volition, and she's subject to a 2 year non-paid non-compete period. And again, these are, one's an employee, one is an independent contractor, so it's worth deciphering that. But like these are kind of like, if I was a boxer, I would certainly at least be aware of these contracts, that when there's one big market power in a TKO/WWE, these are the kinds of restrictions that you can invoke because your independent contractors, your wrestlers, your boxers, they do not have collective bargaining, and it's either sign this contract or you can find work elsewhere.
Yeah, and John, I think you hit the two main points on the head, which is, one, we're dealing with independent contractors. And so if you don't want to work with the independent contractor for whatever reason, why are you preventing them from earning a living, putting money in their pocket, food on the table for a year? That's a pretty gross clause. And why do people sign it? I think you touched on that as well, which is market power. If you have a major promoter with the major stars under their umbrella and you want to be the best in the world, you're going to do business with this major promoter. So it's so easy to say, if you don't like it, don't sign the contract, right? If it's an unfair contract, don't sign the contract. But if you have monopoly power in any given industry, whether it's professional wrestling, whether it's mixed martial arts, whether it's what we might be seeing a few years down the road in professional boxing with this Ali Act nonsense that hopefully doesn't see the light of day. When you get an entity with market power, they could have coercive contracts, and talent are going to sign those coercive contracts because they really have no other choice. There's no other healthy open market for them to make a living. But yeah, when you mentioned that to me, being frozen for a year, I'd like to see a clause like that challenged. I don't know what the judicial outcome would be, but I think there's a good chance a judge wouldn't want to uphold an independent contractor to a one-year ban for making a living in their own industry or even some adjacent industries like mixed martial arts. Like if you freeze out a pro wrestler and you don't want the competing pro wrestling promoters to use them, why are you keeping those people from earning a living in adjacent sports like mixed martial arts or kickboxing or whatever else those contracts have to say? They seem heavy-handed, overly broad, and unnecessarily clauses. They're oppressive, and I'd love to see something like this challenged in court.
It does feel that we have, I mean, as much as we look at, you know, mixed martial arts and to a degree boxing right now, that, you know, there's a lot of fighters that are concerned that if I rock the boat, like I have a very small window to make a living and I don't want to disrupt the industry leader. And we contrast that to pro wrestling. And it's like, we will talk about these things, but this is not something that gets, you know, any kind of like, even like public complaints from any of these performers. It's one where I think they look at it as though like we're so far from any type of organization, any kind of a battle plan of looking at these contracts, looking at the lack of revenue that they will receive when a big broadcast rights agreement is done. Like there's so many parallels, and it all adds up to why TKO is in this position and all of these comparisons you can make between what is in action with this Ali Revival Act and sort of in the UFC and WWE models. Like this is that process in action, and you have talent that are like not going to fight this, even though I think a lot of people are confident a judge would likely look at this with both eyebrows raised. But is that fight going to take place? I'm very skeptical.
Yeah, and you touch on an important point, which is career length, right? Whether it's pro wrestling, where I think the careers can be extended a bit, even though it's a very hard career, mm-hmm. but in pro boxing, pro MMA, when you get to that elite level, and the elite level I'm talking about, I'm a contender, I could challenge for the title, I'm a draw, I'm in my prime. That is such a short window for professional athletes, and to say you're going to be frozen out for a year because you pissed off the big promoter in town and you can't go to the B-League promoters for a year, that's a nasty restriction on trade. And you're right, people, you know, David doesn't want to take on Goliath, but sometimes David does take on Goliath, like the UFC antitrust lawsuit. Some fighters stood up and they were willing to push back, and that cost them $375 million and counting, because there's ongoing antitrust suits against the UFC right now. So I'm not saying that this has to be an antitrust case. I'm just saying whether this clause is individually challenged or whether professional wrestlers want to do what mixed martial artists have done over the past decade, which is get together in an association and push back and earn some of your rights back through litigation or lobbying for legislative reform or other legal steps, that's not a bad idea if there's exploitation in the industry.
And Eric, could you explain for us, let's say Andrade does sue WWE in federal court, even though I think that's unlikely, but let's say it happens. You know, if a judge looks at these, I guess, would a judge look at the contracts and if the judge made an order that, you know, this clause can't be enforced, or even would the judge consider the independent contractor employee issue? Is that something that could, once that order is handed down, broadly affect W contracts?
So I'll be a little careful in answering this one because I'm a Canadian lawyer. We're talking about U.S. labor law issues. I haven't read the contract. There's presumably a choice of law clause in that contract. Presumably that choice of law clause is a jurisdiction that's going to be very friendly to the entity that wrote the contract, the WWE.
I've been told it's federal court in Connecticut.
Is it federal court? And so regardless of where it's challenged, I think the issue of independent contractor versus employee does play a role, because trying to, you know, think of it this way. You hire a plumber to do some work in your kitchen and you're pissed off at them, so you end the contract, but you say now you're frozen out for a year and you can't do plumbing for the neighbors or anybody else for a year. Does that make any sense? It doesn't make any sense. There's not a lot of good reasons to uphold a clause like that, as opposed to a long-term employee. Hey, you work for me. I'm going to teach you the secrets of the trade. Everything you've learned under my watch. I've got some competitors. I don't want you, if we end our relationship for whatever reason, I don't want you going to the competitor down the street with all my trade secrets and harming my legitimate business interests. So there is some validity to looking at this independent contractor versus employee situation. But again, how this would play out in court, I don't know. I personally would love to see a restrictive clause like that challenged, because that seems over the top, seems unnecessary, seems to harm open competition. And I don't see any legitimate business interest that it serves other than being nasty and vindictive to your former talent.
And is that this one more issue to pile on top of an antitrust case, a civil antitrust case?
Things like that play a role, because playing keep away from the competition on the open market is part of it, right? Like in the UFC case, for example, long-term restrictive contracts are part of the nasty business that the court found the UFC was doing. And so when you have the market force, right, when you own the market, UFC basically own US MMA. Like there's very little competition when you look to who else is making a profit in that space. And so when you own the sport and then you wrap the talent up under long-term exclusive contracts, and then when those contracts are over, they're wrapped up even longer with exclusive negotiating periods and things like that. Yeah, the court found those could be antitrust violating practices where you have significant market share. So freezing your talent from the market for a year, that could be frowned upon in an antitrust case. Absolutely.
What kind of examples can you maybe share, Eric, of like these types of non-compete clauses, whether it's for employees or for independent contractors? I mean, it sounds like from my research, like 1 to 2 years, it is not that is a period that you do see in a lot of contracts. But I guess what we're going as well, like, is it typical of an unpaid period as well for a lot of these non-competes, that if a WWE would defend itself as just being competitive with other industries in terms of what protections they are invoking for themselves?
Right. Again, I'm biased with my views in my jurisdiction where I practice law, but I know courts here would have a really tough time upholding this kind of a clause, saying you can't earn a living in your own industry. It's not like you come in and work for my restaurant and you've never worked in a restaurant, and I'm saying, hey, you can't work in a competing restaurant, but go earn a living in anything else you want. This is an independent contractor who, through years of blood, sweat, and tears, got to the elite level in this industry and now can't earn a living in that industry for a year. Courts are going to be reluctant to uphold those kinds of clauses as opposed to an employee situation. That's my sort of broad stroke takeaway on this.
And on the UFC front specifically, I know this became an issue when, you know, George St. Pierre retired at the beginning of 2019, and it was years later we learned that, you know, he had tried to be able to take a boxing fight, and years after the fact was still harnessed by his UFC contract. And, you know, I believe it was on Ariel Helwani's show, he had just stated the fact that it would just be too costly to fight this. And this is someone the level of a George St. Pierre. And then we saw slowly they were introducing sunset clauses, and that's how Francis Ngannou was able to get out of his UFC deal. What is the state of sunset clauses in UFC contracts at the moment, and how, and sort of where things have gone in that sense? Because, you know, there's many fighters. It's like you're, as a promoter, obligated to offer so many fights per year, but like there comes incredible value for UFC that they can hold on to fighters long beyond their competition days if they just want to retire or get out of a contract.
Yeah, and there's a bit of a difference when you have an independent contractor and you end the contract, right? I, as the promoter, say, I'm done with you, but I still want to freeze you out for a year, versus a fighter saying, hey, I'm retired, I'm no longer going to be competing. Cool, but now I want to go compete or fight with a competing promoter. And then the primary promoter says, well, hold off, you still have some fights with us. If you're not truly retired, you're going to be competing with us than with somebody else. It's a slightly different analysis. My understanding is the UFC's gone back and forth on the sunset clauses that after the antitrust litigation started, they did insert sunset clauses, and fighters like Francis Ngannou took advantage of it. Now, I understand this, but I don't know it as a fact. This is just what I've been told, is that those sunset clauses don't exist right now. So there's been a little bit of back and forth there. But the UFC doesn't want those sunset clauses if they could avoid it, because, again, they don't want to see that Francis Ngannou situation repeat itself. They don't want their active champion to leave and then be on the open market for other promoters to have that champion under their banner.
And so we go to a week ago, and we wanted to have you on to kind of just bring our viewers up to speed. The California State Athletic Commission, they had held a hearing back in September about what kind of just felt like they were prepared to support this Muhammad Ali Boxing Revival Act, and they were besieged by complaints and criticisms of the act, and thus they kind of just tabled things. They were going to put together a subcommittee and reconvene in December. Then we moved this hearing up to last week, and we got this much different vibe on this call, where you did have dissenters, but it felt like those, and mainly people with ties, whether directly or indirectly, to TKO on the call. Nick Kahn principally spoke in favor of this, Big John McCarthy, Forrest Griffin, Chris Lieben. And by the end of it, California voted unanimously to support the bill. And while this does not, you know, it's not a passing of the act, it's great support when you have a commission the size of California that is supporting this act. Did I get a lot of those details right about just the dynamics here behind this hearing last week, and why has this caused such a concern among those in boxing of how this act is moving forward?
Yeah, I think you've got the timeline right. So you have the September hearing, and at that September hearing, it seems like the commission wanted to rubber stamp their support for this legislation, okay? They opened up the phones to public commentary, and it was caller after caller after caller saying, this is terrible, this is going to hurt the long-term interests of boxers. Why are you supporting this? And so the commission paused. They said, okay, if we're going to listen to the public, we have to actually be responsive. We're not going to proceed with our vote today. We're going to, as you say, have a subcommittee. We're going to push this back till December. Now, what I don't understand, out of the blue, they had a hearing last week, not December. It's not December yet. We're still here in October, with very little notice to the public. They put this back on their agenda, and they unanimously supported it. And it's not like there was a live debate at that hearing, and when they heard everybody, they said, let's support it. It was right on their agenda that they're going to recommend to support this legislation. So the fix was in before this hearing last week even took place. The hearing was front-loaded, as you mentioned, with a lot of people with some kind of ties to TKO, and they gave statements of support. But when people disconnected from TKO came on the phone, it was the same pushback, where you had fighters, amateur fighters, professional fighters, retired fighters, a lot of stakeholders in the industry saying, this is going to harm the long-term interests of boxers. I can't understand if you say the current model in boxing has problems, but then you create a solution that doesn't address any of those problems. You just say, here's another model where promoters could ignore all of the protections that fighters had when it comes to financial disclosure, and when it comes to eliminating conflicts of interest, and when it comes to nasty things like the promoter controlling the title and the promoter being able to have coercive contracts. That's the language of the Ali Act. You can't have a coercive contract. Under this new legislation, a promoter can have a coercive contract. If you support the new model, why would you also support stripping all of the fighter protections? It makes no sense to me. I don't like where it's heading. I like that a lot of people are standing up against it. I hope a lot more people in the boxing industry take this seriously, because this isn't some distant threat. If TKO is allowed to do business in boxing under this UBO model, they have so much money, so much power, so much media influence, so many political connections, I think they're going to get a stranglehold on the sport faster than many of the existing people in boxing even appreciate. They've never come up against somebody as powerful as TKO. There's a live open market in boxing. You have promoters competing with other promoters. Nobody owns the sport. But when you get somebody coming in that knows how to own a sport, watch out. I think you could have some real harm to championship level boxing purses in several years if this legislation passes.
And Eric, can you explain to us what the kind of the politics are of this? I understand this is a federal law, right?
Yeah, and so that actually makes me wonder why is California even going to bat to it? Because if California wants to change how boxing is done in their state, they're free to do so. But they're coming forward and saying, hey, we support this federal law. And when California says it, they've got some clout because California could boast that they host more professional boxing cards than any state in the U.S. So they're number one by volume, maybe not by money, but by volume. They're number one. So that's a powerful ally for the bill to have. But it's federal legislation. It's before Congress right now in the House. It has to go through committee hearings, has to go through the House, has to go through the Senate. And then the president has to support it. The president is really close, of course, with people within TKO. I don't think there's any opposition from the White House. You know, the White House is talking about hosting a UFC card around the 4th of July.
I'm sure they'll be sitting down and having a lively debate about the merits of this act.
I don't think rigorous labor protections of boxers in 10 years are going to be at the forefront of conversations there. I don't know if they have the support in Congress or the Senate. I don't know that. If you're a boxer and you're concerned about it, I've got two recommendations. The first is reach out to MMAFA, the Mixed Martial Arts Fighters Association. They're your ally. They've been fighting not just for MMA athletes, but for prize fighter protection. So whether you're a boxer, a kickboxer, Muay Thai, MMA, if you want one organization going to bat for your labor rights, it's the MMAFA. So reach out to them and organize with them. Reach out to your congressperson. Reach out to your senator. Tell them why you oppose it. And then get politically engaged right now. Not 6 months from now, because 6 months from now might be too late. Get engaged right now and push back against this UBO model, because it could hurt you in the upcoming years terribly. If you're an amateur boxer, by the way, one of the best people, I forget his name now. I wish I can give him a shout out, but a 17-year-old from Colorado. Amateur
His name was Gabriel. I don't know if he gave a Gabriel. Last name. Yes.
Yeah, Gabriel. That's the guy. Kid 17. He did a better job than almost anybody pushing back against this. And he's right to do so. He's an amateur boxer. He wants to turn pro. He wants to make a living in boxing. And he's saying, whoa, I don't like where this is heading. If I'm going to be a pro in a few years, and it's this TKO model where they get to control who goes up and down the rankings and they get to control who fights for the title, and they don't have to tell me how much money's being made, and they don't want to compete in an open market, I don't like this. This doesn't sound like it's good for me. So if you're an amateur boxer like Gabriel, speak up as well. I think there's a lot of stakeholders. There's a lot of room for more people to come together and to push back against this legislation.
Yeah, and I think it's noteworthy as well that on this call, other than this one amateur boxer, I mean, this was MMA people that were on this call, specifically ex-fighters, including Matt Brown, and it was it almost feels, I don't want to like paintbrush everyone, but it seems a lot of the attitude in boxing is the fact that this is just the latest attempt for a promoter to get into boxing, and they're not really seeing like the weight behind this when you compound TKO with the finances of Saudi Arabia behind it. And with those in MMA are like, we've lived through this. We are the end result of what happens when this kind of control is exerted, and we are a mirror into the future for you. And like, when you look at this, the argument from TKO side has been, hey, we're going to be bringing up the per round minimums. There's going to be health insurance minimums. And like, that's great. But TKO is not investing this time. Nick Khan is not calling in to this to help lift up the bottom tier of boxing. They are coming in because with that give is so significantly more take. And you're looking at what is going to be essentially what we are getting is, hey, boxing is a mess right now. because we have to negotiate with fighters. Why don't we just balance the power on this end and we can operate from the top down? And this will be such a better run business because we could just eliminate all boxer rights and it would be such a cleaner business at that point. Like, that's the overall argument that I'm seeing here. And I don't know if that's resonating to the degree, but even though we have like a whole generation of MMA fighters that can tell you exactly what the vision is.
Yeah, so you're right. The MMA fighters are speaking up because they know exactly what it's like to do business with somebody with monopoly power, or more accurately, monopsony power. And when one promoter holds all the cards and there's no healthy open market, there's nobody that could bid for your services, right? So now you're stuck taking these bad deals. The MMA athletes know these lessons and boxers should listen to them. But it's not that there's no examples in boxing. I think you've just had generations of boxers who've had the protections of the Ali Act, right? The Ali Act, it's two bits of legislation, but basically in 2000, it was created in its current form. So you've had 25 years of these protections. So boxers have come up their whole career with these protections. They don't know what it's like before these protections existed. But if you go back into the decades beforehand, there was monopoly power in boxing. And it took antitrust lawsuits to break that up. So it's not like, oh, that's only an MMA problem. It could never happen in boxing. It can't happen in boxing with the Ali Act. The Ali Act is one remarkably successful bit of legislation. It's anti-monopoly legislation. It makes sure no promoter could control the title. So the top fighters are always going to have access to the open market. The UBO model flips it on its head. It says, let's let a promoter control the title and the assertion or the ascension in the rankings. And if you do that with enough money and enough splash and enough celebrity and enough political connections, it grows to be the sport. If TKO could grow the UBO model to be the sport, now all this other stuff doesn't matter and fighters are going to be in for a rude awakening. But again, MMA athletes know this stuff. Boxers knew this stuff in decades past. That's why the Ali Act came in to begin with. That's why antitrust litigation was necessary to break up monopolies in boxing in years past. So again, wake up, boxers, because the threat is real and it's at your door right now.
Last question, Eric. What are the next steps now for the Ali Boxing Revival Act? What are the next processes that it needs to go through?
Presumably there's going to be committee hearings. There's two committees it's been referred to. So there's going to be some open hearings there. Goes to vote in the House, goes to vote in the Senate. Trump signs off on it. So it's a pretty short window. Things could happen pretty fast. Government's shut down now in the U.S. I mean, I won't pretend to be able to predict how all this dysfunction in the U.S. political process gets resolved. But When government gets back up and running, it won't take long for this to get over the finish line. So you're probably only looking at several months' time, but really several weeks' time, because if there's going to be committee hearings in a few weeks or a few months, you want to make sure your voice is heard right then and there. And I think that's part of what California is doing. California is jumping through some hoops to say, hey, we're now going to go and publicly support this. I wouldn't be surprised to see a guy like Andy Foster at these committee hearings throwing the weight of California behind it. Boxers better be prepared to be organized and throw similar weight back in opposition against this legislation. Otherwise, it could be coming pretty fast.
You can follow all of Eric's work at combatsportslaw.com. Vital resource when it comes to these specific topics. And we really appreciate all the time taking out today to talk about these subjects with us, Eric.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me on. And go Jays.
Yes. We're going to take them to the limit. We're gonna pull it off. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thanks, Eric.
All right, Eric McGraken joining us. So yes, so the future of combat sports looks very bright for all
for
fighters,
TKO.
Wrestlers, talent. Yeah, it looks wonderful for TKO. Which brings us to our next topic, and that is WWE ticket prices. I mean, what happens in this competitive marketplace? Brandon has scoured the Pollstar data, and you have taken a look at WWE. Ticket prices specific to Raw and SmackDown. And what have your findings been? Have we, I remember there was a time that WWE used to market itself as the most family-friendly prices in entertainment. Where are we at right now?
Well, so I looked at, so what is this data? It's Pollstar data, which is, Pollstar is a website and a company that follows the live event business, and we can get some data from them, however they get it, through Ticketmaster audits or whatever it may be. And so we don't have data for every single WWE event, but we have data for a lot of them. And we have this going all the way back to part of 1999. So I made a chart. So the Pollstar data has gates, has grosses, basically the amount of revenue that was sold, the amount of revenue that was generated based on ticket sales. And I narrowed this to Raw and SmackDown. So we've excluded the house shows, which are, you know, changing and, you know, they're diminishing in number over time. And I didn't include pay-per-views, which can, you know, can be very variable and can be all different prices. But so we just focused on the weekly events that are, that have been happening, mm-hmm. you know, twice a week for, you know, since 1999. And we know that Mark Shapiro has been out there talking about margin expansion and raising the prices. And, you know, Vince McMahon was not quite maximizing the opportunity. He was pricing for families. And Mark Shapiro sounds like he's not even satisfied yet with where ticket prices are. In any case,
margin expansion, adjusted EBITDA margin expansion.
Yes, the non-GAAP measure. So you've heard lots of complaints online, I'm sure, about how tickets are so expensive for WWE these days. So I decided to look to see if there's good data to back this up. And no surprise, there is. It's about doubled. So, and I adjusted this for inflation. So no inflation excuses here.
Oh man, the people, they had their bows and arrows out for you.
Yep. And what used to be a $60 ticket price before the TKO merger is now, you know, year to date in 2025, about 120. I've got 118 when it was in the year right before, about, you know, 59 or 60 or something like that. So, and again, this is Raw and SmackDown only. And you know, the natural, and this is a dramatic spike, right? It's not like it was just, this is just a linear progression that it was on its way to. This is a pretty dramatic spike upon the first full year, 2024, and into 2025, continuing to rise upon the closing of the merger. I think it's fair to suppose that this is part of strategy, and you got Mark Shapiro basically saying that it is. Now, the natural question is, well, is this really any different than what's going on in live events generally? We've been hearing, especially since the pandemic, how
concerts,
popular,
Brandon, concerts are so expensive these days.
How popular live events are, and, you know, look at the Taylor Swift tickets. And now there may be something, I did not look at the secondary market here, but if you look at, you know, Pollstar did this article at the end of 2024 where they, you know, went through what's the average North American ticket price for North American touring acts, and I assume that's largely concerts, and it was slightly down from 2023 to 2024, where it was, and this is adjusting for inflation in terms of real dollars, it was 144 in 2023, down a few dollars to 140. So now you could say, look, the average WWE ticket price is still, if it's $120, it's still less than the average concert ticket. You could say that. I'm sure it's less than whatever the average UFC ticket is. But you do get that data, you know, showing you that, well, it's not as if, I mean, there is this increase from 2021 to 2022 to 2023, where it goes from about 100 to 123 to 144, but it's flat from 23 to 24. So this is well beyond what the general market is doing. Suffice to say, for AEW, they're going in the opposite direction. If anything, their ticket prices on the average have diminished from 2022 to the present, where they were at $58 in 2022. Now they're at about $49. Now, granted, we've got a limited number of samples because AEW is a top secret organization. They've got their information on lockdown. They tried to get a government entity in the esports stadium to agree to a confidentiality clause and not disclose any information about their live events. So we've only got six samples in 2025, whereas we had more samples in the past. So they're possibly reacting to our dragging the river for Pollstar data here. I also looked at Live Nation. Live Nation is consistent with what we saw in Pollstar in that the average ticket price is not exploding in conjunction with the trends that we're seeing from WWE.
Yes. But when AEW does announce any upcoming events, you would still get that press release, though, right? They're not that secretive?
Perhaps.
Okay. I encourage people to go. This is up at Patreon.com/Russellnomics, the full
It's free for everybody as well, yes.
Okay, well, go to Russellnomics.com. I support the Patreon. That's
Thank
my
you.
Bookmark.
Please do.
Page. But yeah, it's an interesting comparison point when you're looking at other live events and even like The Athletic reporting that NFL prices actually declined slightly this past season, though the NBA is surging at this point. But, you know, the up until this past season, like NBA tickets were priced in line with what WWE prices are right now. They have since surpassed that. But this is, you know, it's a major growth that WWE has undergone. I guess the last point to your piece, Brandon, and we've kind of been monitoring this of late, like WWE attendances are still, they are doing outstanding numbers. They are still typically for TVs averaging in the 10,000 range. And
right, you know, that's an important point. We've got people, you know, complaining about the ticket prices, understandably, because it's becoming less affordable, especially for a fan base that, you know, the television viewership data that we do have from a couple of years ago from 2023 about income levels is that, I mean, no surprise that the median income level for the typical wrestling TV viewer is well below the median income for the United States. So these prices being high is especially unsettling for wrestling fans, I would think. And you think that they're getting punished now, that the attendance is going down in response to these ticket prices, right? No, it's not the case. Well, but WrestleMania, I didn't like WrestleMania. I think the creative's getting worse. They're getting punished, right? Economic justice? No, it's not happening. Raw and SmackDown's average attendance, according to WrestleTix, is actually up in 2025 year to date from 2024. Continuing what is now the 4th consecutive year of significant increase in their average attendance for Raw and SmackDown. No economic justice here, just profitability and margin expansion.
Well, there's no better evidence for that than the Saturday night's main event that will be December 13th, John Cena's retirement match in Washington, D.C., that tickets went on sale last week, and the queue was insane to try and land tickets for the show. WrestleTix initial estimate 14,904 tickets out. My question will be if this is going to set a new arena gate record for WWE, because the price of these tickets is just insane here. Cheapest ticket available according to WrestleTix, $424 US at the time of this last posting. And you know, this is probably going to be one of the most in-demand events for WWE this year or in many years.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. So let's take a stab at it with math here. $424, let's say they sell, I mean, there's 14,900 out now. They've got a current setup according to WrestleTix of 16,000. So let's say they only truly sell 14,000 times 424, as we all know, is almost $6 million. And that would surpass the record, which I believe is the Netflix Raw debut of 4.8 million at the Intuit Dome.
The Intuit Dome.
Yeah.
Well, they should comfortably be above that level. Also announced quietly on Tuesday and publicly on Wednesday that WWE has once again moved Money in the Bank. I know everyone in New Orleans is like, oh no. Well, folks, they're keeping it in New Orleans. How kind. But instead of running it on August 29th, it's now been moved back a week. So it will now take place on Sunday, September the 6th. And we do have a location announcement now. Prior, it was just announced as New Orleans. They will be running at the Smoothie King Center. For any thoughts that maybe they would take this event to the Caesars Superdome next door. This is in conjunction with the Greater New Orleans Sports Foundation and Legends Global. So what's significant about this date change as well, not to say this was the reason for the change, but initially this event was going to be the day before AEW's return to Wembley Stadium. So we were going to have like dual shows on back-to-back days, and at least in theory, both events will now have their own weekends a week apart.
So this will be Labor Day weekend?
Correct. Right? Yes. I think this is Labor Day weekend. Yeah.
Probably. Yeah, it has to be. So this could go head to head with All Out, depending on when they schedule that. They could just do a Saturday, though.
Yeah, but they've been spacing out All Out further. I don't see them running All Out the weekend after.
Oh, because they didn't do a Labor Day weekend this year.
Yeah, correct? Yeah. They've moved it to mid-September, so I don't think there will be any conflict there. But that's the latest news for Money in the Bank. I still believe this event's going to take place in Winnipeg. I think they're just going to move at some point. I'll believe it when I see it, that they run an event in New Orleans.
Hopefully they've got an ironclad contract
Why didn't they have The Rock come out on Raw to announce this?
I don't know. They didn't want to jinx it, I guess.
A big WrestleMania announcement. All right, we're going long here. I was going to do a bit on the Missouri State Athletic Commission, who I reached out to after WrestleDream.
Did you?
Because I did, and I wanted to know the status of several potential restrictions they had. I was directed, much as Brandon Thurston directed me to their guidelines, which did not contain the words fire in them. I want to know, is fire banned? Did I ask them specifically about fire? I did, and they would not give me an answer that fire was banned, but I think that's a reasonable guess. Water, not banned. Fire, probably banned. So, yeah. And for the benefit of Brandon, I also asked for attendance and gate information, and they kindly told me to F off. So that was the response.
I mean, we did read this, the pro wrestling rules in Missouri on what Sunday morning to,
it's amazing. I've read these before, but it's been a while. So much of it is written as though like this is a shoot and it's very clearly professional wrestling. But then like for any absence of confusion here, I mean, they get right into blading. Like you cannot do anything that would cause actual blood to be exhibited, but you can use a blood capsule just as long as it's not any object that could bludgeon your opponent. But restricting an opponent's breathing, very clearly not on the allowable list. So they snuck this one through or got a one-night allowance.
For the attempted drowning that we saw, the very controversial attempted drowning of Darby.
Do you know how many copycats we've seen since Saturday? I have an update. Still zero.
Yeah. Well, keep your eye on children everywhere. Other very important rules that are in this, that wrestlers may wear two pairs of trunks, one over the other. That's good. That's good to know. If a wrestler wears shoes, they shall be fitted with soft tops, soft, smooth soles, soft laces, and equipped with eyelets only here in Missouri. We could go on and on here, but I don't know how long you want this episode to be. But a very
unsportsmanlike physically dangerous contact banned. The use of the tag rope. I mean, a big this should be the Luthez Act.
This is not unusual. Let's not single out Missouri here.
No,
I've been reading the New York State Athletic Commission handbook for years, and it's been very similar. They're talking about it as if it's a legitimate sport, but also saying no blading and things like that. And I'm sure other states are like this too.
Did you ever wrestle in Missouri?
No. God, no.
Didn't go over there. I would have loved
that. No, I did not.
Some firsthand experience in this commission, but there you have it. All right. More stuff to get to. WBD is for sale. Should we go in on this?
What this means, you know what this means?
There's nothing I enjoy more than
what does this mean for AEW?
We need a soundbite for this segment. It's a recurring segment every single week.
I debated bringing a paper lunch bag on here so I could start breathing.
So that's the story, okay? WBD is for sale. But someone's job was to take that very clear statement and turn it into a 500-word press release and say everything but the word sale. So this is what you get for probably $1,000 an hour from a firm to put together your
strategic
media
alternatives.
While Warner Brothers Discovery continues to advance its previously announced separation of Warner Brothers and Discovery Global, its board of directors today announced it has initiated a review of strategic alternatives to maximize shareholder value. In light of unsolicited interest the company has received from multiple parties for both the entire company and Warner Brothers. Through this process, Warner Brothers Discovery Board will evaluate a broad range of strategic options, which will include continuing to advance the company's planned separation to completion by mid-26, a transaction for the entire company, or separate transactions for its Warner Brothers and or Discovery Global businesses. As part of the review, the company will also consider an alternative separation structure that would enable a merger of Warner Brothers and spinoff of Discovery Global to our shareholders. At the end, no deadline or definitive timetable set for completion of the strategic alternatives review. Other than the separation transaction that's already underway, there can be no assurance that this process will result in the company pursuing a transaction or other outcome. Basically, this means anything could happen. There could be literally any of these options or nothing.
I'm sure there was very a similar press release when WWE announced that they were exploring.
It was exactly the same as WWE said. They always caution nothing might happen for this. Now, this comes in light of reporting of several bids by Paramount. Another bid that was higher than Paramount's, but the suitor unknown. And then CNBC reporting that Comcast and Netflix have expressed interest. Netflix kind of pushing back on that on their earnings call on Tuesday, but not outright stating it. But I mean, Ted Sarandos was definitely kind of throwing a wet blanket on the potential of outright purchasing Warner Brothers Discovery.
Now, remember, and I think they're alluding to it here, WBD is supposed to split as it is, right? They're supposed to take all the old cable assets and split those off from the streaming and the studios, the movie studios and things like that. So I think they're saying it here, right?
The good side and the bad side, okay? David Zaslav gets the good side and Gunther Wiedenfels
Gunnar Wiedenfels.
Gunnar. Shit Co., yes. I think, as it's been tabbed.
Right. So you might see a more complex transaction than just WBD getting combined with NBC Universal or something like that, which NBC Universal has undergone a similar process with Versant. What does this mean for AEW? Is it the end of AEW, depending on who buys it?
Well, the interesting part is that AEW has relationships with both sides of the divorced parents.
Yes, because HBO Max goes this way and TBS TNT go the other way.
Correct. So there would be a co-parenting involved in this split with AEW as the child caught between mommy and daddy.
Yeah. I mean, just to say what we've said before, I don't know, like Paramount could end up getting this, NBC Universal, W has, or TKO has relationships with almost all of the major players, with the exceptions of Fox, unless you count the 2B deal for Evolve, Amazon and Apple, I guess. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the WWE is gonna say cancel them, but it's worrying, I suppose. But then again, if you have a strong show, if you have a strong, highly ranking show, which you know Nielsen measurements notwithstanding, AEW does, that might be okay.
There's so many different ways of where this could go, and
maybe the Khan family could buy it just to make sure.
I mean, that would be the Anthem solution.
Yes.
But you have, you know, these spun-off companies from Comcast, and you have these pending spun-off companies from Warner Brothers Discovery. Like, there's the idea that, like, you could mix and match these to form new companies as well versus outright buying Warner Brothers Discovery. So I think everyone is looking at this. The stock has responded exceptionally well to this news that Warner Brothers Discovery is tabling these strategic alternatives. So they've been very high on this. Unlike Netflix, which did take a bit of a dive last week. I don't know if the market has rebounded a bit for Netflix stock, bringing in $11.5 billion in revenue for the third quarter, which was up 17% from last year. $2.5 billion in net income. And when Ted Sarandos was asked about the potential of a purchase, we've been very clear in the past that we have no interest in owning legacy media networks, and there's no change there. So knowing Netflix's past absolute denial of being interested in certain areas, this would give me grand optimism that they're taking WBD in wholesale, and Ted Sarandos will be the face of this legacy media network.
No sports, no advertising. Here we are.
Yeah. No. Yes. It's all coming in for Netflix. All right. We'll stay on that front because WBD just decides, you know what? Let's raise our prices for Max. Why not? So, folks, if you are a new HBO Max subscriber, just jumping on board for your right to purchase AEW pay-per-views, well, now your ad-supported plan is moving up a buck to $10.99 a month. It's standard plan, $18.50 a month, and then the premium tier. This is where they're really gouging you. $2 increase. What are you getting in exchange for those $2? What added value? Well, you're getting the same thing, but now it's $22.99 a month. All prices USD, and they're going to be introduced right away. Existing subscribers, you get one month until this will be reflected. So just got a little more expensive if you're consuming AEW through HBO Max.
And I was looking at like what it would cost to subscribe to all of the major streaming platforms. And if you bundled in Disney, you get the Disney bundle, mm-hmm. and you can bundle. There is an offer for bundling Peacock and Apple TV. That seems to be the most efficient way to do it. And then to also standalone subscribe to Amazon Prime, HBO Max, Netflix, and Paramount Plus. You're at $93 to subscribe to all of the major streaming services. And I was looking at this is not an advertisement for cable TV or Spectrum, but according to Spectrum's website, which is my local cable operator, who I don't subscribe to or hold stock in, they're offering, it says 100 right here, but you click in and it's like 110 if you want the regional sports networks to get cable. And they claim that they're going to give you HBO Max, ESPN Unlimited, Hulu, Disney, Paramount Plus, Peacock, most of them for like $110. So we're getting to the point, I guess, is the moral of the story of where all this is. It's almost as expensive as cable without the cable.
Ta-da. It's almost like this was the whole purpose of this entire move to streaming. You're still spending the most, but we have an industry that's bringing in a whole lot less.
Yes. Yes. Wow. But flexible. You can cancel anytime. Whereas, you think you're going to cancel cable? Get ready to be on the phone.
Yeah. Well, Antenna, which is a data firm, they got preliminary data for how the new ESPN app is performing. So this, I understand, it's a combination of ESPN Unlimited and ESPN Select, which Brandon can confirm as the American on this show that these are two separate services.
ESPN Select is the former ESPN Plus, I believe.
Yeah. That desperately needed a rebranding, I guess, in light of all this confusion. But ESPN Select will not get you WWE premium live events.
No,
you need ESPN Unlimited to get the PLEs.
Correct. It's unclear how Antenna does this. I understand they do lots of estimates like this. The Peacock numbers, I think, that they've estimated in the past have been in the realm, but it's totally unclear to me how they would, what the methodology would be to do this. But yes, go on.
It's estimating 2.1 million signups to ESPN. It's contrasting here with Fox One, but that's less interesting to our audience. It's worth noting that these figures do not include existing Disney subscribers who switch from other plans or those who activated through MVPDs through their cable distributor. What it estimates here is that 57% of the ESPN subscribers opted for the new flagship Unlimited service, compared to 43% for ESPN Select, formerly ESPN Plus. And they do have a graph showcasing like the spike in subs, which do correlate with like weekend programming on ESPN. It launched August 21st to just over 50,000 subscribers. And then the weekend we'd be most interested in is September 20th, because that's when WrestlePalooza took place. And I mean, you did see a meaningful spike here, but again, this is 2.1 million subscribers between both services. So, and 57% of that number being ESPN Unlimited. So, I mean, we're looking at, a number for this ESPN Unlimited that would be less than what the peak of WWE Network was, for instance.
Yeah. So this is only what they're saying here is this does not include anybody who just gets it as part of their cable
right.
pay TV package.
Right. Which is that is a significant number that would boost this. Yeah.
So presumably, I mean, this 2.1 million, they're paying the $35 a month, or right. they're going to, right? So if just to do the math, if they were to sustain 2.1 million subscribers who are paying $35 a month year round, that's almost $900 million. Mm-hmm. So that'll pay for what is the ESPN W deal? $325 million AAV?
Yes.
Yeah. So that covers it.
No, there you go. That's that's where they are. And this is the more important number of people that are actually paying for this service versus ones that, I mean, yes, they are currently getting it through their cable distributor, but I mean, is that going to be something that lasts into infinity? Like, I think at some point they're going to want to charge people for this service across the board. And I think scare people off immediately by asking for $30 if you're already subscribing. But
and probably,
like, if you're YouTube TV, it's like, I don't want to offer this to people for free and just like jack up or at least include it. Like, that's going to be all of ESPN wants to boast its numbers, but it also wants to get value out of these subscribers.
I mean, it's a tool to get leverage to charge YouTube TV and Comcast more money when they renew their carriage rights, right? And then that's going to get handed on to the consumer, who's going to pay a little bit more in their monthly fee, I think.
On the Post Wrestling Cafe this month, John Pollock and Wei Ting sit down for a new edition of Talk. We are also going back to 1992 to look at the G1 climax from that year. Rich Van and W.H. Park are getting together to review Peacemaker Season 2 and look at Marvel Zombies. Plus, we have Book Club detailing Kamala Harris's new release, 107 Days, weekly editions of Collision Course, and the XL versions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. All can be found at postwrestlingcafe.com.
Anything you took from this past month's Nielsen Gauge report? This was for September 2025, where they break down the amount of consumption of a streaming, broadcast, cable, and other. And then we get a breakdown where it is still YouTube as the dominant streaming platform, followed by Netflix, and then everybody else. But streaming accounting for 45.2% of all consumption. Compared to, broadcast and cable, neck and neck.
Yes. I mean, this is generally what it is. They have started, by the way, we're not affiliated with Nielsen, but they have started to group together the WBD. So this is not just HBO Max here, but this is also Discovery, right? I mean, this is what the story has been all along, right? Is that this is why there's a reason in W's favor to go with Netflix for so many of their rights, because Netflix is by far the winner. 8% of the total TV watch time is happening in Netflix. The next paid streaming service down is Disney, all of Disney. So that's not just Disney Plus, but that's Disney Plus and Hulu and ESPN Select with 4.5%. So roughly half of what Netflix is doing. But the real king is YouTube. Us with 12.6%.
Yes, which have just they've lost the rights to various Ringer podcasts that are going to Netflix.
Yes,
they're getting into the podcast game.
Okay, well,
you and I are not going to migrate to Netflix, are we?
We're open for business,
as always. Final note is from Brandon Thurston, from the desk of Brandon Thurston himself. The latest in your LVCVA petition that is going on. The floor is yours. What would you like to disclose? This is the most transparent man in all of professional wrestling media, Brandon Thurston, who has given us the latest on WrestleNomics about this ongoing petition.
Well, these are public records too. So as people may or may not know, I am petitioning the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority to disclose public records that belong to the public, which are related to W WrestleMania, both this year and the one to come next year. They have been delaying this since my request on April 23rd. They had not responded by late August, so I brought this petition to the 8th Judicial District Court in Nevada. They had not responded until after I moved for default judgment, because they had not responded. They responded right before the deadline to respond to that and did reply. They say they're going to, they said in that filing that they filed October 13th, that they will produce records on October 22nd today. So we'll see if that happens today. However, they've made many claims in the past about what the earliest date they were going to provide records on, and they did not provide records on that date. Instead, they sent me another letter saying they would provide records at the earliest date of a later date. So they did respond. And I responded again, and everybody could read that's free for free subscribers as well as paid subscribers on Patreon and Substack. If you want to read those filings, which are not easy to access, but they are public records as part of Nevada's state courts. You can read those over for yourself.
All right. Well, we appreciate the update, and we continue to follow along as you try to uncover these records that are state secrets under lock and key.
We'll see if any exemptions are claimed by the LVCVA.
And we'll see what happens. They've got like 10 hours or so? Plenty of time.
Well, they're on the West Coast. So in fairness to them, they're on the West Coast, and I usually get notices from them late in the day.
Okay. Well, we're all at the edge of our seat to find out if they respond in time. And if not, let them have it, Brandon. All right. That's going to bring an end to the show. We want to thank Eric McGregor for joining us. Again, you can follow him at combatsportslaw.com. That's your go-to resource for Eric's work. Brandon, he can be found WrestleNomics.com, Patreon.com/WrestleNomics, as well as WrestleNomics on Substack, where he is always dropping new reporting, even new graphics to designate his original.
Oh, the art is very important.
Reporting, yes.
I've decided the art is very important.
Are any of these banners going to be aggregated with your work?
Are they allowed to? I don't want to get into fair use law today. But no, I've decided that the artwork is very important, and that's like, you know, that's why people click and maybe read. Mm-hmm. I hope they read, but I know
you're going with that over like watermarks.
Oh, well, just as a design choice, to make everything look organized and nice and attractive for readership.
Well, you get an A+ on that front. It's the nicest looking graphics, I think, out there. So congratulations on your part. Over at postwrestling.com, tonight, Wei Ting will be joined from Kate from Montreal for a Dynamite. I will be off tonight, as I will be going back to review the violence exhibited during the I Quit match on Saturday between Darby Allin and John Moxley. I'm going to do a shot list this entire match and see the power, the influence that this had on the children. But I will be back later on this week, so you can check out all of that. I'm going to be doing a book club with Neil Flanagan on Thursday. Those are for our Double Double and Espresso members at postwrestlingcafe.com. We're doing a double review this month. I'm going to go through the new Gorilla Monsoon book, but the main event, get ready, folks, 107 Days by Kamala Harris. We have sat down. We have read the book. We're going to go over Kamala Harris's 107-day campaign. No spoilers. How did that election turn out? Find out Thursday on the Post Wrestling Cafe. So that is it for us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back at our usual time of 1 Eastern next Wednesday to go through the latest in workers' rights. Maybe we will have a whole different industry to tackle next week. Maybe we'll have a whole new collective bargaining association put together, and all of these clauses are going to be fought in federal law. Maybe that's going to happen. I've gotten my celebration out already, Jumanji Hunter, but let's not get too cocky. Okay. We have had the celebration from Monday, but now it's on to the future. Okay. We're focused on game 1 and 2, and it's a tall mountain to climb. Okay.
By the way, I was solicited for an opinion by one Douglas Pucci of Programming Insider to predict the ratings, the average viewership for the World Series. And I have submitted my prediction, so look for that on Programming Insider.
Okay. Is Toronto going to be the bane of every programming and advertiser's existence, that we're going to not be as advantageous in the U.S. market?
That's right. U.S. teams only, please.
These damn Canadians. All right. We're coming. We're coming for you, Ohtani. Might take 7 games, but we're coming. All right, everybody. Goodbye.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.